Jamal Wilkes is with us on Sports Byline. Again, the name of the book is Jamal Wilkes, Memoirs of the Original Smooth as Silk, and it's available for you at Amazon.com. One other question about the UCLA years. That was a very turbulent time down in Los Angeles, and you're shaking your head yes, and that can be a very distracting thing. It can be a difficult thing for young people trying to develop as people, mm-hmm. not only as athletes. Tell me about why it continued to work and how that period was for the different players with the different backgrounds on those teams.
Well, that's a very astute observation, and I've wondered about that a lot. Again, it goes all back to Coach Wooden. Here is a guy from Martinsville, Indiana. You know, you can imagine a very small town, and you know, it was his faith in people, his faith in his Christian faith, his faith in something bigger than all of us that led him to be able to deal with all that. I mean, this was the height of the civil rights movement. You know, you had Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You had Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe. You had the Vietnam War, Bill Walton protesting, you know, in the streets. Not wanting to cut his hair, and it was just remarkable. I can only attribute it to Coach Wooden and his family and his belief and faith that he had in people, his love for people, which you didn't think about that while you were a student playing for him. You're just trying to get minutes and trying to, you know, keep up your class routine. But after you graduated and left him, you really begin to understand how deeply he cared about his players and people in general. I met people that met him at a post office for 2 minutes, and he changed their life. And he was just, I'm just going to say it. I mean, this man was just inspired, truly inspired by a higher cause. And his Christian faith really enabled him to bend without breaking. I refer to Coach as a benevolent monarchy. You know, It wasn't of democracy. It would, but he would listen to you, and then he would disagree with you.
You get drafted in 1974 in the first round. Did you care where you went?
I did. First of all, I just wanted to get drafted, but to stay in California, I was so elated, so excited about that. I was real concerned about, you know, going to Cleveland or Milwaukee. Not that there's anything wrong with those cities, but they were very different from what I was accustomed to with the, you know, severe winters and the lifestyle. But I was just hoping to get drafted first because a lot of pundits said, well, he's not big enough for the NBA. I remember a story. I was reading the paper, and they had asked Coach Wooden about it, and he said, well, one thing, you'll never have to worry about Keith pulling a muscle because he doesn't have any muscles to pull. And I did a double take, but that's his sense of humor. He's a very funny man, too, as I realized later on in life. I mean, I'd go visit him. I'm going back to Coach. I'm going to come to your question. But I'd go visit Coach and just sit up there and laugh all day with him. But being drafted by Golden State, I was happy to stay in California, but I was concerned because they were a team in transition, too. Yet, I saw that as an opportunity for me to try and come in and make a difference somehow.
The one thing I always thought is that you were never totally comfortable being with the Golden State Warriors. Now, part of that, I'm sure, had to do with Rick Barry. I mean, there were some good people, but Rick was a horse of a different color almost, in a sense. And you were so team-oriented having been at UCLA, and everything, that this was a different thing. It's one thing to play basketball at a professional level, but it wasn't the family feeling that you had maybe down at UCLA. Am I correct in that observation?
Well, yes, you are. And that was the number one question people would ask me. How are you, being a UCLA guy, a Coach Wooden guy, how are you going to get along with Rick Barry? Now, I knew Rick was a big-time player, but I really hadn't followed him much up until then. And it bothered me, Ron, because people were asking me so much. You know, I figured there must be, you know, this guy must be a problem, you know. But I decided to have an open mind. And so I didn't prejudge anything. And it was about a quarter of the season gone by. And then I realized that Rick was harder on himself than he was on any teammate or any coach or any official that he was very famous.
Well, he had an expectation of himself, and he expected everybody else around him to be as good. I mean, we see that with great athletes. Frank Robinson, the baseball player. I had a conversation with him about that, and that was the thing that drove him nuts, that other players didn't make the commitment that he made. And I always thought that was Rick, but he could have picked a better way to show it.
Well, he could have, but once I learned that about him, I respected that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I respected his professionalism, and you're right, Ron. It was a different environment. It wasn't a unified family-like environment. This was the pros, Rick helped me. Once I learned that about him, then I learned some things about the game from him, about the pro game, and then I eventually found out that he has a really funny sense of humor. But he is very opinionated, and he usually has put some thought, whether you agree or disagree, and so I respect that. But that set the stage for, you know, what happened next, because in the pro game, you don't have to like everyone. Mm-hmm. You don't have to spend a lot of time with them away. You just have to do your job.
There could not have been a better fit for a person or for a team to have a person than somebody like you, because of your personality, your demeanor, your willingness to want to fit in. Because when you have a group of guys like they had in L.A., that to me was the most important ingredient for them to have the success they had.
Oh, you're absolutely right. They're all very successful, all have big egos. There's always undercurrents going on, and unless guys are willing to bend some to try and make it work, make it happen, it can be a very, very ugly situation.
When you take a look at your talents, how did that fit in with the Lakers' talents individually and as a team?
Well, I think, first of all, I learned how to play without the ball. Playing with Golden State, we had a great centers in Clifford, Ray, and George Johnson, but neither one of them was a dominant offensive player. So the lane was open. You could get to the lane. You could attack the basket. With the Lakers, with the greatest scorer in the history of basketball, who, you know, was in the low post all the time. So I had to learn to play, with the dominating center who was in the low post all the time. I had to learn two things: to play without the ball, and I studied Gail Goodrich and Havlicek, John Havlicek, and watch them, and they were always moving. So I tried to always be moving, have my hands ready, but I also had to pick and choose when I went to the basket on offense, because Kareem was down there all the time. And so it would get crowded. He was always double and triple teamed. But on defense, it was an asset. You know, you love having a dominating presence in there because you can take more risk, more chances on the perimeter.
One of the things that you don't see today, when you see a promo for the NBA, it's this player against this player, you know. But when you guys were playing and winning the championships, what a great rivalry between the Lakers and the Boston Celtics. And I've never quite been able to put my finger on what made that rivalry so intense, except for the success that both those teams had.
Yeah, they both had success. Well, part of it was pre-Magic. I think the Lakers had met the Celtics four or five times in the championship game, and never won. So there was kind of a cloud over the Laker organization because they could never beat the Celtics. That was part of the rivalry. And then I think the Larry Bird Magic Johnson also further enhanced the rivalry, made it more of interest to fans and made it more intense, because neither one of those guys liked to lose, right? They wanted to beat each other so bad and one-up each other. But I think those two things contributed to the intensity and the bitterness of the rivalry. Plus, the fans in Boston they're great fans, but they're not if you're the visiting team.
I know. I was doing the Sonics play-by-play when Bill Russell was the coach up in Seattle, and I know what you're talking about that. Boy, I tell you, stuff that came out of the stands when they were in Boston playing at the Garden at that time. When you look back on your career with the Lakers, and playing in Los Angeles, it's a different dynamic than it is. Maybe New York is a little bit the same because it is New York. I doubt that Chicago is. But what is that dynamic that makes Los Angeles for you during that period of time and the winning teams that they had down there? What was that atmosphere like?
It was crazy. I mean, it was somewhat at UCLA, but with the Lakers, I mean, the Showtime mystique. I think what it is Hollywood is right next door. And so the celebrities get involved. They want to come to the games. The fact that it's the second media center in America and one of the biggest in the world. When things happen in Los Angeles, it just reverberates across the country. And And then it was the players that we had. We had an interesting group of players. You know, you have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar from New York City with the skyhook. I mean, the most devastating offensive weapon I've ever seen in basketball, and perhaps all of sports. You know, we had Nixon, myself, Cooper, Magic Johnson, with his no-look passing, and the Hollywood just ate it up. So that our basketball games became more than a game. It was an event. It was a happening. And so you had to take notice, whether you were a Laker fan or a basketball fan, it was such a huge event with Jack Nicholson, Denzel Washington, Diane Cannon, on and on and on, Glenn Frey with the Eagles. I mean, they were there. There were regulars there. And so that just elevated it to, it just became a happening.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I know in the epilogue you wrote a couple of things. You say, I encourage education. Education is the key to unlocking many doors. And you also say, if I may repeat an age-old saying, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. I want to share a personal story with you. And I don't know if you'll remember it, but I think you will. All-Star Game, San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were down there, and I went to a party at Terry Cummings' broadcast production company.
I remember
company.
It.
You
yeah.
remember it.
Yeah.
Now, what I came away with, because I grew up in a military family, lived all over the world, and people are people to me. But I'll never forget, because in that atmosphere, with the league being dominated by African-Americans, there were more black people there than there were white people. And I noticed the white people were all in a tight bunch in one kind of corner of the room.
Yes.
Now, I don't care. I'm walking around. But I went into that production studio, that big room where they were shooting television, and I looked over and I saw you. You saw me. I said, Jamal. You said, Ron. And it was like the sea parted. And we walked to each other and threw our arms around each other. And I always found that that was something that was interesting. I don't know what it is about society, about not embracing people as people. And good people are good people. Bad people are bad people. From your standpoint and what you've gone through and your success in basketball, give me about a minute about how you view society in general from your background and all you've learned.
Well, first of all, in that story, you're such an engaging, open-minded person that, you know, I would do that anywhere with you, and I feel you'd do the same same to me anywhere, because we're people. And I think that's the parenting that's coming out of me now with that epilogue, because I wanted to say something to people about, you know, not getting hung up or distracted with labels and accepting people as human beings, and, you know, who have, you know, who bleed like you do, who aspire for things like you do, who feel pain like you do. And so I was really trying to make the point that, yes, I know that there are labels, and I know they're important, and I know they have meaning, but they're only to a point. And I think there's a point where all of us, myself included, need to continue to get past labels, and because they're limiting, and they can be divisive. You know, if me, a black man, thinks this about you, a white guy, then I get locked into that thinking, and it's going to hurt me, because I can learn a lot from you. You know, I can become a better person from you. So I just try to say that without being too preachy or being, you know, on a soapbox or grandstanding, but just try and put that suggestion out there to people who read my book, which is available on Amazon.com, that we can make this a better world. And
are you happy with the way the book came out in about 20 seconds?
I am. I'm very pleased with it. I think it's a good read for the basketball fan. You know, the fact that I was in two dynasties in all of sports, I think it's a good read, human interest. I think it's a good read for young people that are aspiring to achieve things. I'm very happy how it turned out, Ryan.
I want to thank you for coming in and sharing your life and your story about playing basketball, but also for keeping our friendship intact. It's not how many times we see each other. It's always the quality of the time that we spend together. And I want to thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is called Jamal Wilkes, Memoirs of the Original Smooth as Silk. We still have a lot of things to talk about in this book. You got to come back and see me.
I'll be back, buddy.
So check it out. We continue with more of You and Sports Byline.